So we come tonight to the 13th chapter of the Epistle to the Romans. And of course, you remember that the 12th chapter began the practical aspect of the epistle. And essentially, Paul is, you know, teaching us how to live as Christians. And, you know, the first portion of chapter 12, he's talking about our relationship with God in the sense of our yielding our lives to him, not being conformed to the world, being transformed by the renewing of our minds, finding that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And then from that point, he went on to talk about our relationship with one another in the context of the body, that we're one body, many different parts, that we have a variety of gifts and we're to use those gifts. And then, you know, from there, he's just talking about relationships and you know, commitment to one another and encouragement for one another and passion and perseverance and in ministry and prayer and things like that. So just a number of things that the apostle is addressing here in this practical portion of the epistle. And so now he comes to dealing with the Christian's relationship to the governmental authorities, the Christian's relationship to the state. And it, you know, I think it's interesting that we're here at this point in time because there are some things that are happening both in our particular nation and in other countries. More recently, things have happened where there seems to be more and more of an intentional intrusion by the government into the affairs of the church and even into the personal lives of Christians. And so it's, I think, in that sense, it's relevant to us where we're at. Now, I want to quote to you from a writer who said this. He said, "The church and state have different roles, and that Christians have duties to both God and the state was clearly implied in the words of Jesus, 'Give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's.'" Now, Paul enlarges on the state's God-appointed role and on the role of Christian people in relation to it, although his emphasis is on personal citizenship rather than on any particular theory of church-state relations. What he writes is especially remarkable when we recall that at that time there were no Christian authorities, global, regional, or local. On the contrary, they were Roman and Jewish and were therefore largely unfriendly and even hostile to the church. Yet Paul regarded them as having been established by God, who required Christians to submit to them and cooperate with them. He had inherited a long-standing tradition from the Old Testament that the Lord is sovereign over human kingdoms and he gives them to whomever he wishes. I think that's a good way to begin talking about this. Now, let's look at the first seven verses of chapter 13 here. Let me read them to you. So Paul says, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good, but if you do evil, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For they are God's ministers attending continually to this very thing. Render, therefore, to all their due taxes, to whom taxes are due, customs, to whom customs are due, fear to whom fear, and then honor to whom honor." So it's quite clear the way Paul sees things. And of course, as the writer mentioned, he He is picking this up from a long history of God showing his sovereignty over the nations. One of the things that you see in the Old Testament, much more than you see in the New Testament, is God is involved in the lives of the nations. And we commonly think of his involvement in the life of the nation of Israel. And of course, that was the prime example because they were his covenant people. But when you read through the prophets, you find that God was involved in the affairs of the surrounding nations as well. And he was concerned about what was happening in those nations. And he was, in varying degrees, he was dealing with the situation in those nations that surrounded Israel. So, Paul sees that the existing governmental authorities are appointed by God, and they are appointed by God as his ministers for good. So now we have to understand here, Paul's talking about government in its best sense. He's talking about God's intention for government. Of course, governments tend to become corrupted. And when they become corrupted, then we have to, you know, reconsider certain things when they become corrupted. But in the general sense, we are to be submissive to the governmental authorities because their purpose is to minister good. That is the purpose of government, to minister good. They are, in a general sense, as Paul puts it here, they are basically to keep the peace and to punish evil. That's primarily the task of government. Keeping the peace, allowing for a peaceful society where people can live together and work together and prosper together and enjoy life together. And when things would interfere with that, when evil would press in and try to unsettle that, then the state is there to punish the evil doer. Now, there's a couple things here that I think need to be just briefly addressed. Notice that Paul refers here to rulers being a terror to evil, and he refers to the authorities bearing the sword. Bearing the sword. There's always been debate and controversy in the church about the issue of capital punishment. And there have been Christians who have not accepted that the New Testament could teach such a thing. They have taken passages, for example, from Matthew, where Jesus says things like love your enemy or turn the other cheek or things like that. And they say, look, this is the New Testament mandate. Punishing criminals and especially punishing them with death would be inconsistent with the heart of Jesus. But here we are in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul is writing. He's writing by inspiration of the Spirit, and he's talking to us essentially about capital punishment, because the sword was the symbol of the state's authority to execute wrath upon the evildoer. And so all that to say, the New Testament supports capital punishment. God instituted capital punishment himself back in the time of Noah. After the flood, God declared that if a man was to shed another man's blood in a murderous act, not in an unintentional death, but in a murderous act, that man's blood was to be shed. That man was to be put to death. And so the institution of capital punishment by God in the time of Noah has been, you know, carried on all throughout the theocratic kingdom of Israel, and then over into the New Testament period, as we see here. Paul is recognizing that the government has the authority to punish evildoers, and in some cases to punish them with death. Now, the other issue that comes here is the issue of taxes. And this is a very relevant topic, isn't it? Because Cheryl and I are just in the process of doing our taxes, so it's relevant to us. We're hearing about budgets, and we're hearing about deficits, and we're hearing about new taxes or no new taxes, and taxes are as old as the human race, basically, and nobody likes to pay taxes. I don't know. President Obama says he doesn't mind, and he wants to set an example for other rich people, that they should all pay more taxes. So I guess there are a few people that don't mind paying taxes. I guess if you have so much money that paying taxes isn't going to affect you at all, then it's not a problem. But most people don't have that kind of money, so paying taxes generally, gets to people. But again, this is one of the things that the New Testament states, not just here, but in a variety of places, that we are to, relation to our citizenship and our connection with the state, we are to pay taxes. And remember, again, Jesus said, render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. So Jesus acknowledged that there was a place for this to be done. So Christians are to pay taxes, again, because there's, in one sense, the state has been appointed by God to minister good to people. And, of course, there are lots of good things that happen through our tax dollars. And I think, for the most part, people are fairly reasonable. If your tax dollars are being spent on worthwhile things, then you understand that, well, this is just what we have to do. I think where people get frustrated, of course, is when they see their tax dollars just being absolutely wasted or spent on things that the government shouldn't be spending them on, or things that we absolutely do not believe that any money should be spent on. But just in a general sense, taxes have their place. You think of the benefits that we get from paying our taxes. We have wonderful roads to drive our cars on and to be transported around the country on. And that's a blessing. And so we see that, there's a benefit there from paying taxes. To think of, parks and beaches and recreational places that are, the responsibility of the state. And it's through taxpayers' money that they take and they beautify these places and they make them, a place where a person can enjoy themselves and have some benefits of fresh drinking water and toilets and, things of that. I think that's a pretty good use of taxpayer money. As I'm running along the beach in the morning, I'm very thankful that there are bathrooms down there, and I'm thankful that as I run along, I can stop and get a drink of water. So I'm trying to look at the positive side of the whole tax thing. But of course, the police, those that protect us, those are positive things. Thank God we have a police force. Thank God we have people that are out there, watching out for us and protecting us against criminal activity and so forth. The courts, again, another example where evildoers are punished. And then we have a military, and the military, of course, defends the nation. So there are benefits from taxes, and God, according to Paul here, God has set up government. It's a God-ordained institution, government is, so that life can be lived with order and a relative amount of peace, and in the end, it would be an enjoyable experience. Anarchy is not a preference. We need government. We need rules. We need structure. We need those things to to thrive in life. So the rule, according to Paul in the verses here, is this. The rule is that Christians are to be law-abiding, tax-paying, submissive citizens. That's the rule. So when you're just looking at it generally, that's it. We're not to be, just breaking the laws because we don't think that's, I don't like that law. We're not to be evading our taxes. We're not to be rebellious as citizens. We're to be submissive. That's the rule. But there are exceptions. And we do have to recognize that. So granted that the authority of rulers is derived from God, what happens if they abuse that authority? If they reverse their God-given duty, commending those who do evil and punishing those who do good, does the requirement to submit still stand in such a morally perverse situation? The answer is no. The principle is clear. We are to submit right up to the point where obedience to the state would entail disobedience to God. If the state commands what God forbids or forbids what God commands, then our plain Christian duty is to resist, not to submit, to disobey the state in order to obey God. Whenever laws are enacted which contradict God's law, civil disobedience becomes a Christian duty. So again, we see this demonstrated in the scriptures. So the general rule is that we're submissive to governmental authority. We are abiding by the laws. We're paying our taxes. But there are these exceptions when a situation develops where the government becomes so corrupt and starts to impose things upon its citizens that are contrary to the Word of God. That's when we are allowed by God Himself to disobey. You think of the situation back in Egypt. Many, many centuries ago, Pharaoh had given the command that the Hebrew midwives, they were to destroy the male children that were born. But we're told that the Hebrew midwives feared the Lord and they disobeyed Pharaoh. And it was during that time that Moses was born. During the time of Nebuchadnezzar, you remember Nebuchadnezzar had made that great image of himself and he commanded everyone to bow down and worship that image. But there were three in his kingdom that refused to do so, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And to them, that was a violation of the commandment that you should not bow down or worship any image. That's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar was requiring, and they resisted him, and rightfully so. Or you think of the decree of Darius in the time of Daniel, when Darius was tricked into making a law that no one could petition any god for a period of 30 days. And we read, when Daniel understood that that had been signed into law, that he went up into his room, opened his windows, faced Jerusalem, knelt down and prayed, because that had been his habit for decades. So he resumes his habit of obedience to God. And when we come to the New Testament, we find that the apostles were being ordered by the Sanhedrin, which was the civil authority in Israel at the time, not to speak at all ever about this man, Jesus. They were not to teach or preach in the name of Jesus at all, and they were severely chastised, and they were warned not to do this. And they went out and they did it, and they were arrested again. And when they were brought back before the authorities, they said, "Did not we command you not to teach or to preach in this man's name. And they said this. They said, whether it be right in the sight of God to you, you've got to make that conclusion. But we've already decided we have to obey God and not man. So we're not paying attention to your decree. God told us to go out and preach. You're telling us not to? We got to do what God told us to do. So you see, these are the exceptions. There are those times when we have to disobey the civil authorities in order to be faithful to God. And as I said a few minutes ago, it's interesting that at the present time, we are seeing not just here, but here for sure, and yet in other places as well, we're seeing the government that is, in, for the most part, in the Western part of the world, having been influenced by Christianity for so many centuries, had been relatively passive in regard to any kind of overt hostility or persecution or anything like that. We're starting to see that things are changing. And we're starting to see Christians being sued over things because they're not complying with the state's regulations on things. I'm thinking of a couple in the UK who, a Christian couple who owned a bed and breakfast. And they had a simple rule at their bed and breakfast because they were Christians that if you weren't married, you couldn't stay at their bed and breakfast. And they weren't, you know, hostile toward people or they weren't angry or aggressive. It was just a simple rule. Well, what ended up happening is a couple of gay guys booked a room. And when the proprietor understood that, you know, they had a relationship with one another, he said, well, you know, I'm sorry, we try to get you in a room down, you know, in another place or whatever, but we just don't allow this here. And that couple then went off and sued them, and the courts decided in the favor of the gay couple and punished the couple that owned the bed and breakfast. And essentially sort of drove them out of business. And I'll never forget reading the ruling of one of the judges in the case. And he basically said, look, I understand how they feel. And I know that for centuries, that has been the perspective and the understanding of people within this culture. But this is what he said. But you know what? Everything's changing. And whatever you have believed about this, you're just going to have to disregard it now, and you've got to fall in line, and you've got to conform to these new rules, is essentially what the judge was saying. And the kicker was this. The guy was an elder in his church. The magistrate was an elder in his church. But he was saying, well, look, you know, we just got to go with what the government's doing here. And we can't resist it. We can't oppose it. We can't disobey it. So these things are starting, and that's just one example. There's more and more of these kinds of things going on these days. And then, of course, here we're seeing this intrusion, this sort of crossing over this boundary that's been set up by the Constitution, the boundary between the church and the state. And as much as the Constitution declares that the church is not to influence the state in the sense that the state's not to promote any particular denomination as above or favor a denomination over and above another one, the Constitution also says that the government is not to infringe upon the rights of the church. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. They're not to restrict the free exercise of religion. They're not to interfere. But we see right now, I mean, it's as current as tonight's news, the present administration is seeking to impose standards upon religious institutions that violate the teaching of the institution and the conscience of the you know, those involved in that particular faith community. And the government's essentially saying, look, too bad. This is what we've decided. This is what you've got to do. And so, you know, there's a diversity of opinion. Some people say, oh, it's not that big of a deal. It's just, you know, they're not doing it to churches. They're just doing it to these, you know, hospitals and so forth. But the bigger point here is really, it's an assault on religious freedom. That's really what it is, because they're essentially telling people that, you know, it doesn't matter what your convictions are, the government's going to overrule your conviction. Now, some people say, well, that's not that big of a deal. And, you know, to a lot of people, religious freedom isn't that big of a deal. Some people would say, well, if they wanted to take away religious freedom, who cares? I mean, I'm not religious. Not going to affect me. Well, don't kid yourself. It's going to affect you. Because that's the first step in absolute and total mind control. Because what they're essentially saying is, we're going to tell you how to think. And if you think differently than we tell you you can think, then we're going to punish you. And it'll start here with the obvious people that we don't like the way they think. But then it doesn't stop. It won't stop. It'll just keep going and going and going to pretty soon you have basically a totalitarian system where you have no freedom at all. You have no freedom of conscience. You have no freedom of thought. So it's a bit of a diversion here that I'm on, but it's relevant because this is what Paul's talking about. He's talking about the rule is that we're submissive to the governmental authorities. We recognize that God is the one who ordained government for the good, but we also realize that governments can become corrupted. And the tendency of government is to become corrupted. And so as a government becomes more corrupt and moves away from the ideal and disregards the laws and the commands of God, or even the laws and the commands that the nation was established on, like the Constitution or something like that, that inevitably leads to an oppression and a persecution of those who resist, and an imposition of things upon people, the government forcing things upon. And so we're seeing it. It's happening all around us today, and we don't know where it's going to go. But, you know, we never were guaranteed a constitution in the Bible, and most people have lived without a document like that that protected their religious freedom. Most Christians throughout all of history have been persecuted, suffered for their faith, and much of the time they've been persecuted at the hands of the state. So we've been somewhat exempt, and of course we pray that that tradition might continue on and that there might be a reassertion of the important value of religious freedom, but we just don't know. But we do know this, the Lord's in charge. We're trusting Him and we're obeying Him. And to sum it up, we are to submit to the state's God-given authority, but it has been given for particular and not totalitarian purposes. So in a general sense, we're to be good citizens. Only when there are these exceptions are we then to take a different approach to the situation. So, Paul's talking about our relationship with the state, but then he moves in verse 8 to our neighbor. So, remember, he started with God, presenting our bodies a living sacrifice. He went to the relationship within the church family, the relationship between the believers. He comes to the relationship now of the believer and the state. And now he's really talking about our neighbor in a more general sense. The general sense of, you know, as was asked Jesus. Jesus said, the great command is to love God with all your heart and to love your neighbor as yourself. And somebody said, well, who's my neighbor? And then Jesus went on to tell the story that we commonly refer to as the story of the Good Samaritan. And the point that Jesus was making is, look, your neighbor is anybody that's in need. Your neighbor is whoever you happen to be nearby, who needs to be loved and needs to be reached out to. And so here in verse 8, he says, owe no one anything except to love one another. Owe no one anything. We're not to be in debt. In debt meaning we are not to incur debt and not pay our debts. The Bible does not prohibit us from taking a loan, for example. Some people have thought that. Well, you know, when you take a loan, you're in debt. Yes, but that's not what the Bible's prohibiting. The Bible is prohibiting taking a loan, going into debt, and then not paying your debt. So that's all that is forbidden. So we're not to be indebted in that negative sense. The debt we are to have, the ongoing debt, is to love one another. So Paul said earlier in this epistle, he said to the church in Rome as he was writing to them, he said, I am a debtor to you. I'm indebted. I feel an obligation. And so he's using the same terminology here. This is the obligation that we are to have toward our neighbor. It's the obligation of love. Owe no one anything except to love another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, are all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So this is the great command. The great command is to love. Now, I want you to see this in the bigger picture of the epistle. Because if you remember earlier, Paul went to great lengths in disputing with the Jews who were part of that group of people that he was writing to, in disputing with them about the law. And of course, they were insisting that the law was necessary for justification. They were not wanting to accept the fact that a man is justified by faith alone, apart from the works of the law. So, you know, Paul argues through all of that. We've been through all of that. But it's almost as though, as he comes to this point here, he sort of comes back to that argument and says, okay, look, if you really insist on bringing the law into this, well, this is how you do it. You love one another. Because if you're deeply concerned about fulfilling the law, this is how the law is fulfilled. All the law is fulfilled in this one saying, love your neighbor as yourself, because as he goes on and he shows, if we're loving, we're not going to be committing adultery with our neighbor's wife or husband. We're not going to be committing murder. We're not going to be stealing or bearing false witness. We're not going to be coveting the things that belong to our neighbor. So everything is really summed up in this command to love. It's all right there. And when we sin in any of these ways, what we're basically doing is proving that we're not loving our neighbor. But this is the command. This is what God has called us to. He's called us to love. And if there's one thing that would be the mark of the Christian church, if there's one thing in the Bible that you could, you know, pull out and say, okay, this is the identifying mark of the Christian church. This is the identifying mark of Christian people. If there's one thing, you would have to say it's love. Because that's what Jesus said. Jesus said, all will know you are my disciples if you love one another, if you have love for one another. Now, that has probably been the greatest area of failure in the whole history of the church, the failure to love one another. It really has. And, you know, if you look at church history, if you follow the stream and right to this very day, you don't have to look far, you just see that so often Christians themselves do not love each other. We so easily get pitted against one another. We get jealous of others, or we covet things that others have, and we get angry, or we get offended and we don't forgive, and those things fester through the body of Christ. And then, you know, from the personal level, we can take it to the level of, you know, sometimes groups within a local church, or sometimes, you know, local churches against other local churches in the community, competing with each other and jealous of each other and slanderous of, you know, the church down the street and all of that kind of thing. I mean, it's just this insidious epidemic that the church has suffered from throughout all of these ages. And, you know, we can't really do anything about what's already happened. But what we can do is we can, by the grace of God, do our best to make sure that we're not carrying on that negative legacy, that we're not perpetuating that, that we're not continuing to promote that kind of division and that lack of love. By God's grace, we need to love our brothers and sisters. I mean, that's where it starts. You know, the command, of course, goes out beyond, but we've got to start right at home. And as we learn to love one another right at home, it's going to help us in learning to love others a little further out and a little further out and a little further out. That's what God is wanting to do. We have to resist the strong temptation to be always critical and always looking for fault and always ready, you know, to point the finger at somebody because we have a disagreement with them about something. This is the tendency that we have as people. We just have those critical tendencies. We have those tendencies to want to find fault or to think that, you know, our group is better. Our way is better. And therefore, there must be something wrong with that particular group over there. But that's not love. And I really think that if we as the church would learn this priority or supremacy of love, if we would really start practicing this amongst ourselves, it would revolutionize our churches and it would have a tremendous impact on our communities as well. And it will just, you know, keep going out. So this is the word. Owe no one anything except to love one another. This is the debt that we all have, and this is what we owe to each other. We owe it to each other to love one another. And we've got to ask the Lord to help us where we struggle. We've got to humble ourselves. We've got to not allow bitterness or unforgiveness to dominate our lives. You know, we have all that we need to get rid of that stuff. We have all that we need. God has made it available to us. for us to have the kind of community that the Lord longs to see. You know, remember in Revelation chapter 2, there's one of the churches that receive a letter from Jesus. It's the church of Philadelphia. And, of course, Philadelphia means brotherly love. And, you know, I think if you could just sort of summarize what God intended with the church, it would be Philadelphia. He intended this, you know, to be a community of love. And remember that the church is really like a new humanity, is what it is. It's a new community. The church is actually, according to Peter, the church is a nation. So we have all of the nations of the earth, and then the church is another nation, but this nation is made up of people from out of every other nation who have been born into this nation now through faith in Christ. And, you know, if you think about nations, you think, you know, nations sort of develop reputations. They have reputations for being, that's a productive nation. That's a prosperous nation. Or that's a warlike nation. You know, they over time, they develop reputations for being certain kinds of nations. Well, the reputation that the church, the holy nation, is to have is that reputation of love. It's to be a community of people on the earth that love each other, where all of those things that divide everybody divide the nations from one another, and then divide the individual people in the nations from each other. Those things are set aside. And you come in, and it doesn't matter what color you are, and it doesn't matter what your income is, and it doesn't matter what you dress like, and it doesn't matter what your educational accomplishments are. All of the things that tend to divide people and put them into different categories and exclude them from one another, all of those things in the church are to be put aside. It's to be a nation of love. People can come in and just say, wow, this is the greatest nation on earth. But again, this is where, tragically, the church has failed so miserably, historically. Failed miserably. And it's such a battle. It's easy to understand why the church has failed, because it's just in our nature to not be loving. Or it's in our nature to just love a certain few people. The ones that make us feel good, or the ones that agree with us, or the ones that do everything the way that we think it ought to be done. That's just the way we are as sinful human beings. But of course, the other component in this nation is we're not just sinful human beings anymore. We are new creatures in Christ. We've been born of the Spirit of God. And the Spirit of God has power over the flesh, and the Spirit of God is able to give us grace and love and an ability to do the things that we couldn't do if we just had to do it in our own energy or by our own determination. So we have the resources available, but what's the problem? The problem is we haven't really availed ourselves of the resources. We haven't really taken what God has given to us and applied it. But we can do it. We can do it by the grace of God. We can do it because that's the will of God. We can do it because this is what God desires. This is what Jesus said. Everyone's going to know you're my disciple if you have love for one another. So, how do I get that love? Well, you know what? I ask for it. Lord, help me. Help me to love. Help me to love like you love. Fill me with your love. Lord, show me how much I need your love myself. And then through that, it's almost through that, naturally, we'll have more of an inclination to give love to others. You see, it's possible. But the flesh wars against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh. It's a battle. Because we are opinionated and this is going to be this way and this is what I think. And, you know, there's a point where we just have to let that stuff go. So, loving. And I love what it says here in verse 10. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Love does no harm. You know, recently somebody was telling me about a conversation with a Muslim. And the Muslim was talking about the superiority of Islam over the Christian faith because Islam had all of these laws and all of these regulations and all of these things, you know, built there into the Sharia system and all of that, and tells you exactly how to do this and that. And, you know, he saw that as, you know, see, it's superior because you Christians, you don't really have that. And this is what he said. He said, you just have this like love one another thing. I can't remember who was telling me this, but the person that was telling me this said, yeah, that's right. And let me tell you why that is better. It's better because love does no harm to its neighbor. I don't need 1,000 different rules that I might forget half of them anyway to try to memorize and to, you know, walk along and make sure I'm never in violation, or the 613 commandments that the rabbis established or whatever. I don't need that. I just need one. One single rule. Because love does no harm to its neighbor. If I'm loving, I'm not going to be killing anybody, obviously. I'm not going to be committing adultery, as we've already said. I'm not going to be slandering. I'm not going to be judging critically. I'm not going to be lying about people. I'm not going to be trying to defame them. I'm not going to be hurting them if I love them. And this is the beautiful ethic of the Christian faith. It's one simple rule that encompasses everything else. All of the law is filled up in this one thing. Love your neighbor as yourself. So that's Paul's word. He says, you want to fulfill the law? All right, I'll give it to you. Here it is. Love. That is the fulfillment of the law. And so it starts right here. It starts right at home with us. And as we cultivate love among ourselves, and then it extends itself out from us. And as it goes out from us, it's people are being touched by it. People get impacted by that love. They get moved. They get drawn in. And as we love our neighbor in the sense of the person next door to us, or the person that we see in need, or the person on the job that nobody's taking the time of day to say anything to, or whoever it might be. As we go out with this mandate to love, as we live according to the picture that the apostle has painted here for us, three things are going to happen. Number one, we're going to please God. We're going to please the Lord. This pleases God. The Lord delights in this. This is what he wants for his children. We're going to please God. Secondly, we're going to glorify God. We're going to glorify God in that people are going to look at us. Remember, Jesus said, "So let your light shine before men that when they see your good works, they will glorify your Father in heaven." They'll look at us and go, "Man, there must be something to this Jesus stuff because these people are different. That person is different." And then thirdly, we're going to influence others toward God. We'll become an influence. People are going to look at us and say, "Man, there must be something to this Jesus stuff." And then they're going to say, "You know, I want to check that out. I'm going to pick up a Bible and start reading it. I want to drop in on the church and see what's happening over there because I like what I see with these people." I was talking to this young guy recently, and his background is sort of secular Jewish. His ethnicity is Jewish, purely secular. He said, you know, he's kind of between an atheist and an agnostic. And he happens to work at a place where a lot of Christians are frequenting. And as I was talking to him the other day, he said, "Yeah, you know, I'm, that's what I am, kind of atheist or agnostic. I'm not quite sure." He said, "But you know, I gotta say, I've had to really start rethinking my position because I've been meeting all these wonderful Christian people." And he was dead serious. He said, "I've just been so impressed with these Christians that I've met." That's great. That's what we want, isn't it? You see, pleases God, glorifies God, and others start to say, "You know, yeah, I don't know. You know, I'm kind of an atheist or an agnostic, but there's something about these Christians. I don't know. Maybe I ought to check that out a little further." So, this is it. In our relationship to one another in the church, in our relationship even to the state. And, you know, let me say one more thing about the whole thing with the state. It was no accident that this New Testament was written while the Caesars ruled the world. And as corrupt as our governments might be today, they're certainly not as bad as things were back when Paul wrote this. And if Paul could say at that time, under the reign of none other than Nero, "The authorities that exist are appointed by God. Submit to the authority." You know, we have to be really careful about that kind of, you know, rebellious sort of thing that can rise up in us when it comes to the government that we're under and when they do things that we don't like. You know, a lot of times we, and I'm guilty of this. You know, you just look at it and you just think, you just get so angry and you want to say, want to say unkind things. You want to talk about that person. And, you know, this is how they are. I think of Paul wrote to Titus, and he said an interesting thing. He said, listen, he said, "Speak evil of no man, for we ourselves were once disobedient, deceived, And he went down a little list there. He basically said, we were at one time no different than they are. Speak evil of no man. And I get tempted to speak evil of people. And when I look at the way things are going and the things that people are doing and what they're saying and all that, I'm tempted to speak evil. When I was in New York City in September of 2001, and the terrorist attacks had taken place, and we were there in the city ministering, working with the Red Cross and ministering to the people. I'll never forget, Mike McIntosh was there, and Mike was... We were all kind of stationed in different places around the city. And Mike happened to be in this one place where it was a place where they had just thousands of photographs of loved ones. And it was kind of like a shrine, but it was also, has anybody seen my daughter? Has anybody seen my dad? Here's a picture of him. And there are thousands of pictures aligned on this wall. And Mike happened to be there, kind of stationed there on this particular night, just there to minister and be available. And while he was there, Bill Clinton came to visit. And later on, Mike was telling us, about his brief encounter and conversation with President Clinton. And when Mike told us just about this brief conversation and exchange, I was so convicted by his respect and his demeanor that he showed toward the president. It really convicted me because I had, just unkind thoughts, to say the least, about President Clinton. And seriously, though, when he shared that, it was like the Lord just convicted me. Speak evil of no man. And right here in our text, give honor to whom honor is due. I mean, Peter says a similar thing. Peter says, honor the emperor. What? You're kidding. But you see, I'm saying this because I think we have a tendency, sometimes as Christians, we have a tendency, we see this guy, he's in office, we don't like him, we don't like his policies, we don't like what he stands for, and we want to just let him have it with everything in us. And we don't feel the slightest conviction whatsoever about speaking evil of him because as far as we're concerned, he is evil. And this is wrong. And we should, but no, we shouldn't. See, that's the point. We should from our own perspective on it. But that's not the perspective that we're going with. We're going with God's perspective. Speak evil of no man. Honor the emperor. Give honor to whom honor is due. One last thing, and I'm finished. And it's along those same lines. I saw, and this is a fantastic thing, if you want to watch it on YouTube, the National Prayer Breakfast a couple weeks ago in Washington, D.C., there was a guy who spoke there named Eric Metaxas. And Eric's... among other things, he's an author. He's written, most recently wrote a book on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And he had previously written a book on William Wilberforce. And he was the keynote speaker at the breakfast there, the National Prayer Breakfast. And President Obama was there, sitting just a few feet away from him. And as I watched this thing, and as I watched, he gave an unbelievably powerful speech. Seriously, you ought to watch it if you get the chance. But he was so respectful to the president. He was so honoring of him. He was at the same time very bold in his statements and what he had to say, But he, you know, really treated him the way the Bible says we should treat people in those positions. And so, God wants our witness to be thorough in all of these different aspects of our life, in relation to Him, obviously, in relation to one another as the church, but even in our relationship with the state, with the government, with the authorities, in our relationship with our neighbors, the people that we meet on the streets, the people that are there where we're working or whatever. He wants our testimony to be broad, and He wants it to be dynamic and impactful in all of those places. And so if we just take the word to heart, and if we put that priority that He's put there, love does no harm to its neighbor, love fulfills the law, we will do what God intends that we do.